This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox, in for Farai Chidea. On today's roundtable, air traffic controllers and the FAA are at odds over work hours. The safety of the flying public is at stake. Plus, a new study on whiteness reveals how much keeping the white race white matters to white people. Joining us today from our NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. economist Julianne Malveau, president and CEO of Last Word Productions, Inc. Hello, Julianne.
Hi, Tony. How you doing
today? I'm doing fine, thank you. And from our New York bureau, Bob Meadows, writer of People magazine. Nice to have you, Bob.
Thank you.
And Walter Fields, CEO and publisher of the NorthStarNetwork.com. Walter, how are you doing today?
Just fine. How are you doing?
We have so many topics, so let's just jump right into them. Before we get to the promoted ones, I want to jump back to the segment we just had about capital punishment and ask the three of you really briefly, do you think this brings to an end this issue of lethal injection as cruel and unusual punishment, or is there more to come? Julianne.
I think there's more to come on the death penalty, and this is a subset of it. The fact is that the Florida Bar Association, not exactly the most progressive, said that they oppose the death penalty because in one-third of the people who it's been imposed on were later exonerated. So whether it's cruel and unusual punishment, obviously it's not a walk in the beach, but the death penalty is simply wrong in a civilized society.
Bob Meadows, what do you say?
Again, I disagree with the death penalty. I don't support it. There's not enough safeguards to protect innocent, as Julianne pointed out. A third of the people have been exonerated. But no, this will not end it because you have a lot of people in the country who do support it. And even those who don't, you figure, well, if you do have the death penalty, lethal injection is probably the most civilized way to go. As things we've seen thus far.
Mm-hmm. Walter, you want to chime in on it?
Yeah, I think that, you know, once again, we're going to see some problems down the road because we don't have an exactness in our criminal justice system that gives us any assurances that many people on death row should actually be there. So I think it's always going to be problematic. I'm sort of split down the middle. Generally, I don't support the death penalty except in cases when children are murdered. But I think the dispensation of justice in the most extreme cases is always going to be problematic because in this instance, we really don't know what the person being executed goes through. I mean, it's sort of a very inexact science in terms of the threshold of pain that they're in. So I think that there's still a lot of work to do in terms of looking at this particular issue of lethal injections.
All right, moving on. You know, here's a subject we probably we're going to be at a disadvantage, I suppose, the four of us, to talk about this a little bit because none of us is white. But it's about this new whiteness this new whiteness study. Do white people care about being white? Now, it was long held that they didn't have to. But a new study says, yes, they do. And they are more aware of the privilege that being white brings. But less than half of those surveyed thought that the government or institutions made a difference in terms of that privilege. So, Julianne, are you surprised, not surprised, no big deal? What do you think?
Not surprised at all. I mean, white skin privilege is something that's been discussed. It's the whole issue of whiteness studies is a new academic thing. And I think that white people are always implicitly aware of the privilege that they get, although they tend not to articulate it. Funny case from a few years back. White woman went to get artificial insemination and mistakenly got black sperm. So she ended up with a black child. She sued the sperm bank for $15 million. That was the value she placed on the discomfort that her child would feel over the course of her life because she was black. Well, you know, we could all line up for that $15 million, but that particular case acutely makes it clear that white folk are aware, if not of the advantages of whiteness, the disadvantages of blackness.
That's interesting. Bob Meadows, what about the whiteness studies as far as a curriculum? What do you think of that?
That was always a thing, you know, Black History Month, when it's White History Month, of course, it's 12, not 11 months out of the year. That is what we have every day in schools. That's what I went through in school. And I came up in Detroit, which is a mostly black city. You have whiteness, you have white culture. But the thing that I do want to say is here in New York, white people are definitely proud of who they are, proud of their heritage. You know, the Kiss Me, I'm Irish. My friends of Italian and Greek descent, they wear that with pride. So that's not a surprise at all. But again, the white culture studies, mm-hmm. what class is not that?
Well, that's an interesting question. What's your take on it, Walter?
Well, I think, you know, the privilege isn't a visible benefit. It's not as if somebody hands them a card and says, you're now, you know, you now have this asset because you're white. I think one of the issues that...
At least we think not.
At least when they think, that's right. They could have a card that we don't know about.
We didn't get one.
That's right. But I think what we're beginning to see because of the demographic changes in the country, there's an identity issue with whiteness that I think many whites now feel threatened because you're beginning to see the numbers shift. So I think more and more you're going to see these examinations of what it means to be white in America, particularly as the numbers begin to shift towards more people who are black and brown. So it doesn't surprise me that you have these whiteness studies popping up. Actually, it's very interesting. I mean, if it's done in a way that is an honest discussion, it could really shed light on this issue of privilege. The question becomes where are the studies being done, what institutions are looking at this issue. But for the longest time, I've always said, I think there needs to be a full discussion of this issue of white privilege. White people need to understand and experience the flip side. And the only way you can do that is understand your privileged position.
You know, it's too bad. We should have had a white person on the panel today. We really, to have this discussion be more comprehensive. So if we revisit it, which we probably will, we're going to invite someone white to join us and talk about this. I know, Julianne, we want to have you back on that day.
Absolutely. Make sure you get a conscious white person, not an unconscious.
Yes, we will definitely do
okay.
that. Moving on. West Philadelphia, born and raised as the Prince of Bel Air talked about. You know, I was thinking about this story about the hair braiding. I mean, my hair is short because I like to keep it simple. But I've thought about my son, who's a college sophomore, and he gets his hair, you know, braided and all the stuff that the young people do. And people come over to the house and they sit down, and, you know, either to listen to music or they go into the kitchen or wherever. And it takes hours and hours and hours from people who just do this as a way of making money. And now the state of Pennsylvania has joined about 9 other states who are saying, look, you know, you people who are braiding, you need to be licensed. There's sanitation issues and there's obviously economic issues involved. So let me start with you, Julianne. Your hair is short, too, isn't it?
My hair is short and it has been braided, but not recently. But let me tell you, there's an organization, there's a company in D.C. called Cornrows and Company, and they came up against the same thing. This has been happening all over the country, and it's more like, you know, I think it's about 12 or 15 states that have taken some position on this. But Cornrows and Company, brother and sister, have a great place, and the police came and told them they needed to be licensed because they were doing cosmetology, but they used no chemicals. They challenged it, and not only did they challenge it, but they and won in court, but they also started this organization called American Hair Braiders and National Care Association. And they have on their website all this stuff about just literally what's going on. And what emerges from here is this really is about cosmetologists trying to get in our Kool-Aid. Because even if you, you know, it's 1,200 hours to get this cosmetology license, which will cost you $5,000 to $10,000. But you don't need a cosmetology license. You're not using chemicals, etc. So then they've come up with, many states have come up with a limited license, as Philadelphia is suggesting, 300 hours. But they have no curriculum, no one to teach it, no tests. So again, it just seems to be a nuisance. And in many of the states that have imposed the 300-hour requirement, they can't enforce it because they don't have anyone to teach these classes.
But what about this? What if you go to have someone do your hair because, you know, the price is right, or, you know, so-and-so knows somebody who knows somebody who knows somebody, and yet the person does it and they yank on your hair and they start pulling it out on the sides because they didn't know what the heck they were doing.
Get up out the chair. I mean, it's real simple.
Well,
you know, you get referrals. I don't think that the state, I mean, certainly, and I think this organization talks about issues of training and sanitation and safety. They produce a sanitation and safety handbook. And there are a couple of issues. Clearly sanitation.
Certainly.
Clearly the issue of alopecia, the, you know,
right,
scalp disease. There are issues. But here's the deal. If you're going to regulate, you have to have something that's connected to the regulation. And having someone go to classes with hair dye and all that is not going to do it. So if the state wants to regulate, make it relevant.
Well, guys, what do you say about that? Either of you, are your hair, do you have your hair?
I have dreadlocks.
Yeah, so tell us.
But I used to have short hair, of course, and
okay,
my hair has been many different lengths. I got to tell you, I'd like to be in an uproar over this, but I'm really, really not.
Okay.
Here in New York, you know, they have licensing for all these different hair techniques. And I have to admit, you know, when I would go into the barbershop, I would be looking for that license up on the wall. I'd be looking for that jar of disinfectant, you know,
right.
Make
okay.
sure they put the razors in it and the blades in it every time they cut somebody's hair. When I started getting my hair locked, you just look for that license. And yeah, I know what you're saying, Julianne, but, you know, you go to a beautician and all of a sudden all your hair falls out, you're going to be wanting to have somebody accountable for that.
You know,
and with this licensing, can happen. I mean, that's very, very important.
That is. Walter,
New York isn't doing the licensing. New York is not licensing braiders because
they have
only one school.
Here in New York.
They have only one school in New York State.
But
that has
something?
A course, and it's in Westchester.
That can be addressed. I have absolutely no problem with licensing these folks because, number one, it's not going to knock out the underground business. And I think you have to assume the risk yourself if you go to someone who's not licensed in any of these capacities. If I go to a barber who's not licensed, I have to assume the risk if he jacks up my hair.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't have a problem with them being licensed because I think there are some public health issues. I think there are some professional standard issues. And I think if you're going to operate a business, you should be willing to be licensed. I don't see a problem at all with this. I think part of this is just trying to create an environment where the consumer has some degree of confidence that the person who is working on their hair is skilled, is paying attention to health standards, and that there will be no problems going forward. I think you can make the license cheap enough where it's not onerous. I think you can put the training together with very little issues. All these people who are braiding hair can certainly be part of the regulatory process if the state so chooses to involve them. So, you know, on a surface level, I don't see a problem with
it at all. Let me just throw this one little bit into the Kool-Aid with the three of you, and that is, how much of this is concern over the fact that there may be some other folks who are not black who could jump into this business and just start making all the money?
You know something? I hate to say this, but hair is hair. I mean, we went through this with the hair care products companies
mm-hmm.
when larger white companies began to buy those black hair care products and companies. And mind you, it was that black hair care products company that made the decision to sell those businesses off. So I don't think you can necessarily not do something for fear that other folks are going to enter into a market. You just have to provide the best service possible, and it's going to be up to the consumer to determine whether or not they go to person A or person B. But to not do something because you fear that white folks are going to suddenly get into hair braiding, I think, you know, is a fear that we shouldn't invest much time in worrying about.
All right, let's go on to our last topic because we've only got about 4 minutes left, and this is important. I mean, hair is important too, but you know, we all fly.
Most important thing.
But I'm concerned about who's watching that screen when I'm up in the air. And there's an issue now between the FAA and the air traffic controllers. Did you know that this group of controllers who came in after Ronald Reagan got rid of the others 20 years ago, they're starting to retire now. And what's happened is the contract that they had they've come to an impasse where the FAA is saying, look, we need you to be at that screen longer than 2 hours, and the air traffic controllers are saying, look, that's a dangerous situation. They point to what happened in Kentucky a couple of weeks ago with that air traffic controller situation down there. So how concerned do you think we should be about how long these people are sitting or being forced to sit at these radar screens?
I think we should be extremely concerned. I mean, this is insanity. The 4 hours that they're accustomed to is a significant amount of time to take it up by 5.5 hours. You don't even have these TSA people who are sitting there screening your baggage doing anything for more than 30 minutes at a time because of eye fatigue. And if they have eye fatigue just trying to look for something in your pocketbook, I mean, what kind of fatigue do you think people might have looking at planes that potentially would collide? It seems that the FAA has been very petty here. The other thing they're spending a fair amount of time doing is imposing a dress code. I don't care what these people wear. I mean, what they wear is less important than how accurate they are in steering planes. And so if they're dressed casually, I don't think it's a problem. I think that what we're dealing with is an economic issue, an industry that's in some trouble, and the FAA's attempt to extract the very last dollar and last amount of effort from these folks.
Do you fly a lot, Bob?
Yes, I do, actually.
So this is an issue for you, too, yeah?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. It's an issue for anyone who flies the friendly skies. You know, there's, 14,000 controllers in this country. And the issue is, of course, it only takes one mistake.
That's right.
You know, that's the tragedy here. What happened in Kentucky was that controller only had 9 hours between shifts and only got a couple hours sleep. When they came back, the planes collided, or the plane crashed, I'm sorry.
Right.
And so, yeah, it only takes one mistake. And this is, as Julian pointed out, this, I believe, yeah, this is a money issue, because all these people have been on the job for 10, 20, 50, 25 years, and they make a decent, you know, pretty decent salary.
$100,000, yes.
I read total compensation was about $165,000, mm-hmm. including benefits. And so, yeah, it probably is a situation where the FAA is trying to push these people to the brink so that they will retire voluntarily and so that they can hire in people making less money.
But isn't it a responsibility, Walter Fields, of the FAA to try to do this in a cost-effective and efficient manner?
I'm not so sure. I mean, my first private sector job out of college was with a startup airline for 3.5 years as a ground manager at Washington National Airport. And I will tell you, if the public really understood the dangers involved in air traffic control, I think you'd have many less people traveling. Most of the incidents that happen never get reported, number one, and most of them occur on the ground. We have a real problem in this country in two areas. One is the controllers, and the other is airspace, that particularly around large metropolitan areas, we have so much congestion that we have overtaxed the system. I think these controllers are making some legitimate claims in terms of fatigue, because it's a very difficult job to sit in front of that radar screen for over 2 hours watching blips go by, and I think there is an issue of fatigue. I think the government has sort of shirked their responsibilities ever since Reagan dismissed all of the air traffic controllers. And they're trying to squeeze more out of individuals when actually what they probably need to do is add more controllers. I don't care what you pay them. When you think about the cost of not paying them and not having people who are fresh on the job, it's tremendous. So I think this is something that the public really needs to pay a lot of attention to, because in some parts of the country, we have maxed out on our ability to handle air traffic.
Guess what? I mean, we have maxed out on our ability to continue this conversation today. I sure want to thank all three of you. In Washington, D.C., economist Julianne Malveaux, president and CEO of Last Word Productions, and from our New York bureau, Bob Meadows, writer of People Magazine, alongside Walter Fields, CEO and publisher of the NorthStarNetwork.com. And let me just say to the three of you, I know somebody that can braid your hair real cheap. Call me after the show. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.